You are listening to the Tricorder Transmissions, episode 77. And
now,
here are
Craig
and
Jeff.
Welcome back to the Tricorder Transmissions, episode number 77. This is our commentary track for The Savage Curtain. We are your hosts, Jeff Hewlett.
And Craig Cohen. And we have some sad news this week. And I gotta say, Jeff, that this was really, really shocking. We lost Grace Lee Whitney this week at the age of 85, late last week. But the age of 85, but the shocking thing about it was she wasn't sick, and we interacted with her last August at the Star Trek Las Vegas convention, and she looked and sounded great.
I know, that's the part that really shocked me, is I have a lot of memories of being at that Trek convention, and you had gotten your picture with her and some interaction with her before I did, I think a day before, but... Yeah. My biggest memory was that we had talked with Harlan Ellison before that, and I had gotten an autographed issue number one of the City on the Edge of Forever. And after that, I had taken it over, and I remember I had gone to Grace Lee Whitney's table after that, and I had shown it to her, and I remember distinctly her talking about how happy she was at how beautifully her character was drawn in the comic. And we were talking with her for what seemed like forever, but I think it was really 20 to 30 minutes. But
yeah,
I remember how lively she was and how happy she was. And she just seemed so alive. And to think that she went from what we saw not that many months ago to passing away, that's what really shocked me.
Yeah, yeah. And she was incredibly gracious with her time. In addition to Star Trek, she really spent the bulk of her life, the last 35 years of her life, helping people. She was a recovering alcoholic, and she spent the last 35 years counseling, speaking with, encouraging other addicts.
Yeah, yeah. That's such an admirable pastime, and you know, that's something that, you know, hits really close to home for me, and I respected her so much for what she had done in giving of herself and helping other people to recover from the, you know, alcoholism and other substance abuse issues. And I thought that was a wonderful, wonderful thing. And I remember her telling a lot of stories about that when we saw her.
Well, she was very proud of it.
Yeah. Oh,
as
she should have been. And, you know, one thing that really stuck out to me was how close her and Harlan Ellison were.
Yeah.
And they did a panel together. And I thought it was such a wonderful, wonderful thing that he acknowledged, you know, who she was and what she had done for everybody else as part of the reason why they were so close. And
Didn't he bring her flowers?
He did.
Yeah.
He did.
That was very cool. And you know what else I was thinking about? I mean, her character on Star Trek, Yeoman Janice Rand, was on, what, 7 episodes?
Right, and several of the movies.
Yeah, yeah, and she came back for the motion picture and some stuff after that. But the thing is, you know, for the amount of episodes she did, you know, Yeoman Rand is really a character that people remember. And I bet you there's a lot of non-Star Trek fans out there, or, you know, casual Star Trek fans or people that saw it in syndication, that would think that Yeoman Rand was a series regular.
Oh, for sure. And, well, I mean, she was intended to be. Yeah. Regular, and you know, the network put the kibosh on that, but you know, she was intended to be Captain Kirk's love interest for the series. And if you, as a Star Trek fan, read the first book in the Mark Cushman series, you get a really good insight into what happened to her character throughout those first few episodes and why she was jettisoned from the series. And you know, I highly recommend to anybody out there who's listening to this who doesn't know the story, you know, pick that book up.
Yeah.
And read about it and understand what was behind the whole thing and what went into that in the series. And I think it will open your eyes a lot to her character and where it was intended to go and where it wound up stopping.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. So, yeah, we just want to take this moment to acknowledge Grace Lee Whitney's passing and to also pay tribute to her. And also, I just really I'm really glad, Jeff, that we were able to meet her last August and really able to thank her and interact with her for all, you know, all she did for Star Trek fans in terms of coming out to conventions and just really, you know, keeping herself accessible. It seemed like it was something she really enjoyed doing. You know, you go to conventions sometimes and you see people there that don't look that thrilled to be there. And Grace Lee was the exact opposite of that.
I agree. And, you know, one thing that I am thinking about right now that really makes me thankful that she was able to attend that last convention was, and I know you'll remember this, was that there was a very young lady at that convention who was dressed up. The hair and all, everything. She was dressed up as Janice Rand, and she couldn't have been more than her early 20s.
Yeah.
And she looked just like Janice Rand so much that during the Grace Lee Whitney and Harlene Ellison panel, Grace Lee brought this young lady on stage to showcase her costume.
What a thrill.
And it was incredible. And this it was a beautiful moment.
Yeah.
And, you know, I thought that was a great tribute to her character on the show, that somebody loved the character so much that they would create this costume and the hairdo and the look. And if you search on the internet, you'll find pictures of it. I know it because I've done it before. So if you're a Janice Rand fan, please look that up on the internet and you will see the pictures of Grace Lee with this young lady who dressed up so wonderfully. And I'm sad that she's gone, but I'm happy that the last convention that she attended, she got to witness this young lady's tribute to her.
Oh, definitely. Totally.
So it was amazing. Wonderful, wonderful thing. So we're here to talk about the Savage Curtain.
Yeah.
And we're going to forego the rest of any Trek news this week in memoriam of Grace Lee Whitney. And we're going to move on with our commentary track for the Savage Curtain, which originally aired on March 7th of 1969. And the remaster came on June 28th of 2008.
All right. We have the NBC press release, which reads, Captain Kirk and Mr. Spock are forced to fight for survival with reincarnations of the most evil representatives from history in The Savage Curtain on NBC Television Network Star Trek, Friday, March 7th.
All right, and we will get started with our scene-specific commentary. If you're with us, please queue up your DVDs, your Blu-rays, your online streaming episodes, and we are going to get started in 3, 2, 1.
Now, is it me, Jeff, or is this a very similar opening to last week's episode? Music-wise and everything.
Very close, very close. Yeah. So, you know, the only difference is that last week we had a little more ship in space before the planet came into view.
Yeah, it seemed like the music cue's exactly the same, though.
Very, very similar. Very similar. Yeah, well, one of the differences is that Chekhov is back.
Yeah, well, that's always great to see.
Yeah. Very different. Nice to see Chekhov back in action. So really cool remastered effect. I love the planet that we're seeing because we can see some lava and some heat down on the planet there. Very, very cool replacement. If you look at the original version of this versus the remaster, there's a significant difference in what the planet looks like. And always good to see the Trinity on the screen. So we got Kirk, Spock, and McCoy together on the screen there. And very cool to see the three of them together. We don't see a lot of that in the third season.
Yeah, and doing what they do best, which is argue. And
exactly.
Then the second thing they probably do best is singing Row, Row, Row Your Boat.
Well, we won't get to that until we do our commentary on Star Trek V, which is going to put me in the bad guy position. But I'm waiting on that. I'm waiting on that. But, you know, dear listeners, I want you to pay very close attention here, because we're going to see the McCoy is going to say a very interesting word here very shortly. And I want to point that out, because I think it's the only time in the entire series where he says poppycock.
Oh.
Yeah,
I think we passed it.
Oh, we did. Yeah, you're right, we did. I was consumed in something else, but so we're McCoy, of course, is on the bridge, and we're seeing this is the thing in this episode, I think, that takes me completely out of the story and Star Trek in general, is the fact that we have Abraham Lincoln floating in space on a leather armchair.
That's an iconic image, though.
It is. Now, I'm not going to say that this is going to affect my commentary for the rest of the episode, because it's not, but I remember the first time that I saw this particular scene of seeing Abraham Lincoln on the viewfinder and seeing him recognize Captain Kirk completely took me out of Star Trek. I'm sure that there are many people who will disagree with me, and I know we've seen things prior to this that should have desensitized me to this. Omega Glory, calling Omega Glory out, but for some reason, to me, seeing Abraham Lincoln floating in space on a leather armchair. Now, maybe in 1969, when this was originally broadcast, it wasn't as off-putting, but here I am, almost, 50-ish years later, thinking to myself, this is later on in the episode. Let me back up a little. Later on in the episode, we're going to understand the time frame in which this episode takes place is 3 centuries after Abraham Lincoln died.
Yeah.
So knowing that this is 300 years or more after Lincoln died, it amazes me to no end that Captain Kirk hasn't found another person in 300 years worth of history to idolize other than Abraham Lincoln. And that's why Abraham Lincoln is now floating in space in front of the Enterprise.
Go ahead. I see your point there, but it's not something that ever crossed my mind as being far-fetched. I mean,
really?
I don't know. I mean, if you look at the impact historically that Abraham Lincoln had and the kind of president that he was, it's not shocking to me that somebody, 300 years later might still find traits, that they admire, especially considering that history's really selective in who it remembers. But even some of our presidents don't get remembered.
Of course.
But Abraham Lincoln sort of transcends that.
Oh, I would not presume to debate you on Abraham Lincoln's credentials as being a very remembered president in the annals of history. But if you look at prior Trek episodes and who has been brought forth as surviving history and transcending themselves into other planets and galaxies, it's been godlike beings so far. Yeah. I mean, Apollo comes to mind.
Yeah.
The thing is that I guess in my own mind, it's not so much as Abraham Lincoln's stature in history.
Yeah.
But I think it's more the fact that there have been 300 plus years of human evolution in history in which nobody has come forth in Kirk's mind that can equal or exceed Abraham Lincoln's stature.
Yeah. But you know what else? This is one of those things where throughout the course of this series, the writing has been more convenience-based than anything else.
Sure, of course.
And I think this is one of those cases where instead of creating some kind of fictional character that we don't know, you somehow grounded in reality.
Absolutely.
I think it's funny because I think one of the the many things you could probably fault this series for is plot conveniences.
Sure. No question.
I love the full dress gear here. We see basically dress gear for every class, right?
Yeah. Even the lowly red shirt security guards have dress gear on with white belts to hold their phasers.
Yeah. I don't even think like on Journey to Babel, or Babel, nope. we saw like full, you know, everybody in full dress gear,
I do too. And I love the fact that Scotty, because of his Scottish heritage, has to wear the extra filigree on his outfit. But one thing before we lose this, I want to mention one thing that happened during the prior scene that we glossed over is the fact that Abraham Lincoln and Captain Kirk were kind of in a brief exchange about the measurement of time.
Yes.
And Abraham Lincoln asked if they still measured time in minutes. And Kirk made the remark that they no longer measure time that way, but can convert to it. So in the future, in Star Trek time, 300 or 200 and something plus years from today, our time is no longer going to be measured in minutes, hours, seconds. They're going to measure it in some other format that we're not aware of, but they can convert to it.
Yeah. Well, I wonder if that ties into, that probably ties into the star date.
Perhaps.
But I mean, why? I mean, a minute's so perfect.
I guess so. We all agree on the Earth that it's perfect.
Oh, okay. So in outer space.
Maybe it's not. Maybe other races on other planets have other ways to measure time that may be superior.
Yeah. I like the reverence that everybody's showing for the president.
I do too. But the question that jumps to my mind is, and after all the experience that they've had, and I'm happy to see the fact that they have security guards pointing phasers at this Lincoln character, who may or may not be the actual Abraham Lincoln. I'm glad to see they're finally acknowledging some of their past experience. You have a guy who is claiming to be Abraham Lincoln. He's floating in space on a leather chair. Kirk buys into it, allows the guy on the ship, but still, he insists on having security guards there who are able to hopefully defuse the situation if it goes bad.
Yeah. And I think the big red flag here should have been when they were beaming, getting ready to beam him up, and Scotty indicated that whatever they had locked onto was mineral based.
Right. So yeah, we understand that down on the planet they were scanning rock based life forms that suddenly appeared as human before they beamed Lincoln up. Which is that should let us know ahead of time that we should be cautious here, as well as the rest of the Enterprise crew. You know, and I'm really glad to see that through this particular sequence and the sequences following this, that there are finally some cooler heads that at least try to debate the situation.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's it's nice to see that, you know, the fact that they pulled Abraham Lincoln into this, at least they gave the audience enough due that they had a few minutes of debate on whether or not, you know, Kirk and Spock were doing the right thing and beaming down to the planet, and whether or not this was actually Abraham Lincoln, because we've seen so far in the series a couple of instances where people from Earth's past have been brought into the Star Trek present that turned out to actually be those people from the past.
Yeah.
So it's nice to know that they're at least acknowledging some of the scenarios where they've been rused. Mm-hmm. Into thinking that somebody was something that they were not.
Yeah.
So, oh, great nice shot there. That. Oh, excellent remastered shot of the ship flying over this lava planet with this recently converted portion of the planet that is Earth or Class M habitable. Mm-hmm. Right. You know, and even though Kirk buys into this whole Lincoln thing, it's at least there's an undercurrent that he's skeptical.
Yeah.
You know, I'm glad to see that he's not just blindly buying into it, and Spock is not blindly buying into it either. So I mean, they know that he may not be human by the fact that it was living rock, prior to him beaming up to the ship. So it's nice to see Kirk at least acknowledging that. And it's funny that Chekhov is no longer at the helm here. Two completely unreferenced and unnamed people are sitting at the helm of the Enterprise right now.
Mm-hmm.
Chekhov is in the captain's chair, which is odd when Kirk is on the bridge.
Oh, yeah, totally.
And Chekhov is mysteriously absent.
Yeah, yeah. And now we've got this meeting where they have what could be considered an awkward exchange between the president and Uhura about her race.
Yeah, this was a little, he calls her a negress.
Yeah, and she doesn't take offense to it, which I think is supposed to be the shocking part of the exchange.
Right, and I love her response to it. And I think this is one of the testaments in this series to Gene Roddenberry's vision of the future. And she explains that she doesn't fear words, or they don't fear words in the future. I mean, this is something that today is a very prevalent theme.
Yeah.
In our own society, and the fact that labels are feared and instantly reviled against. And in the future, in Gene Roddenberry's Trek universe, 200-ish years from now, they no longer immediately autopilot take offense to labels and words, and instead use logic and rational thinking to respond to these words and these labels.
Yeah.
So something that I think we could benefit from today. And, you know, Craig, something that I wanted to mention too, another thing that we glossed over prior to this, in the transporter room, when Abraham Lincoln was about to beam up, we heard the familiar whistle tones of the acknowledgement of the beam in, you know.
Yeah,
the,
yeah, that's my text message alert on my phone. And
how often have we heard that in the original series? Is this the first time we've heard that?
Oh, you know what? I have to think about that.
I don't recall hearing that prior to this. So this is our first "Hey, listener" moment, where we'll say, listen, if we're mistaken here, and if Matt Walsky and any of other our listeners have heard that prior, that whistle tone prior to this episode, let us know. Because I don't remember hearing it prior to this. So returning to present day and the scene that we're watching now, I love the fact that McCoy and Scotty are debating the safety of Kirk and Spock beaming down to the planet's surface in this current scenario. So Abraham Lincoln has asked them to beam down with him to the planet's surface to do whatever. And McCoy and the Scotty are the voices of reason here.
Yeah, and it's funny. Mark Cushman points out in the season 3 volume that this is very reminiscent of a scene in Return to Tomorrow.
Oh, yeah.
Where you have them arguing in this very room.
Oh, excellent.
Trying to convince him not to beam down. So it's pretty funny. There were a handful of episodes that this episode could be compared to, but Mark does point out that this is almost a fully repurposed.
No, that's a great observation, but I think it helps to point out the fact that this happened very few times, though, in comparison to the amount of times they beamed down into dangerous scenarios with no debate whatsoever.
Yeah.
I personally, as a fan of Star Trek, appreciate this minute worth of debate.
Yeah.
That you would hope would take place in every potentially dangerous scenario, that it should be truly democratic, because we've got so many scenarios where the captain, the first officer, and potentially the doctor,
yeah,
the ship's main surgeon, beam down into potentially life and death scenarios with no questioning whatsoever, yeah, from the crew. I love this minute or two spent on this debate, and I really would have no objection to a similar debate being injected into every episode where potential danger is imminent.
Sure. So that's one of the things that if this was on the air today, every week we'd have this scene.
Yeah, we'd have like what 5 to 10 minutes of this.
Yeah.
In every episode, but
yeah.
You know, Craig, I wanted to mention to you as well before we wind up beaming down to the planet and losing sight of the Enterprise. Something else that stood out to me in this episode as a head scratcher was that Lincoln asked to take a tour of the engine room.
Yeah.
As a what we're going to find out is a rock creature who was metamorphosized into a human. How would Lincoln himself know about the engine room of the ship and ask to tour such a place?
Yeah.
You know, Lincoln, as somebody who was, prominent in the 1800s, was there such a thing as an engine room back then?
Not an engine room, no.
No. So maybe on a train.
And look, and Lincoln's not even standing correctly on the transporter. Mm. Look at that. He's got almost a quarter of his foot off.
Yeah, look at that. I mean, so there should be a piece of foot left.
Yeah.
After but he beams down.
They did leave behind their communicators and or no their phasers.
Yeah, so we've got phasers and tricorders somehow are left behind, communicators or not. But is this the first time we've seen physical objects left on the transporter after a beam down?
I think so.
It may be. So we're establishing a premise here that it is possible for pieces aside, things that are not human, pieces that are not connected to your body, to be omitted on a beam down. So in this particular instance, we see Kirk and Spock still have their communicators with them, but their communicators, their phasers and their tricorders for some reason have been left behind. Phaser, I can understand, but tricorders, why?
Yeah.
Hmm. And there's a scene where McCoy is in the transporter room. Apparently he has nothing better to do in sick bay.
Yeah.
Nobody needs his attention.
And I got to say that on the Enterprise, I thought Lincoln looked really good.
Hmm.
The seams start to show, though, on the planet for me for some reason.
You think it's the lighting?
It might be the lighting. Yeah, I don't know. It's just on the Enterprise, I was like, wow, that's a damn good Lincoln.
Mm.
So well, now we have this reveal of this, Sorok, the most famous Vulcan of all time.
Right, the father of the modern Vulcan way. So he is the creator of the logical way of life. And, you know, I have to say that we rarely see other Vulcans on the original series. So this is a rare treat. For me and for everybody else who's a fan of the original series. So we're seeing not only another Vulcan, but this is a very significant character in the Vulcan mythos. So, pay particular attention to Surak and his dealings with Spock, especially here in this scene where we're going to see a little bit of dialogue between Surak and Spock, and I don't recall seeing any emotion on Spock's face when he originally saw Surak, but Surak himself picked up on the fact that Spock had an emotional reaction to seeing Surak or quote unquote the image of Surak, and asks for forgiveness.
Yeah,
for having that emotional reaction. So this is almost like a Dr. Phil of the Vulcans, right?
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah. Yeah, this is a very significant moment in the original series. So we're finally getting a little more backstory into the Vulcan way of life here, which I would be remiss if I didn't give a head nod to the fact that the series is finally giving us a little more insight into the Vulcan way of life here. And, you know, this could have, if this was a series that was happening today in a modern setting, you'd probably got two or three or four episodes with Surak giving little tidbits here and there about his contribution to the Vulcan way of life. Unfortunately, back in the 60s, you didn't get more than one episode with a character in it. But, you know, this is one of those scenarios where I think you and I benefit from looking at this episode from a what if it was made today angle.
Yeah. And now we've got this amazing, amazing rock creature.
Well, you know, dude, this is one of the very few instances in TOS where we see a non-humanoid alien. And this harkens me right back to The Devil in the Dark, because that was where we saw like a rock or mineral based alien creature. And this is the next time we finally, many, many episodes later, get to see another creature who is rock based. I think it's fantastic. And, you know, it's kind of cool that they give this character, this rock based character, some humanoid traits. You know, he clicks his claws together in order to summon these bad guys here.
Yeah.
Now we'll get more into these bad guys here in a second. You know, we got Genghis Khan, of course, somebody from Earth's history, Colonel Green, who is another character from Earth's history, that we are not aware of, Zora, who is another evil character who did scientific experiments, and Kalis, who was a very significant Klingon. This is the originator, the original first ever emperor of the Klingon Empire.
Yeah.
So two very significant characters. We've got Surak, the father of the Vulcan way of life, and Kalis, the first emperor of the Klingon way of life. So pretty incredible from the perspective of an episode that is typically considered one of the poorer episodes in the original series. You've got a couple of characters introduced here who have a lasting impact on the Star Trek universe. Very, very cool. So once again, we've got a challenge here that is initiated by said rock creature. And unfortunately, we're going to see our heroes, Kirk and Spock, with their two pacifist allies being pitted against these ruthlessly evil characters from various other planets and races across the galaxy. Almost seems unfair.
Yeah.
Almost seems unfair.
Yeah. So I think it's worth noting, we talked about Gene Roddenberry a bunch, but he actually has a story credit for this episode and wrote at least parts of the script before it seems he lost interest. But he co-wrote it with Arthur Heinemann, who we've talked about before. He wrote the teleplay for Wink of an Eye, and he wrote The Way to Eden with D.C. Fontana, writing under the name of Michael Richards. So very interesting to see a late season three episode with a Gene Roddenberry story credit.
Absolutely, because, you know, we as original series fans have come to understand that Roddenberry kind of checked himself out during the third season to work on other things. I guess he was resigned to the fact that this was going to be the last season of the original series. So it's nice to see his name pop back up.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, this is another one of those instances where, you know, the aliens here have exhibited an interest in seeing a conflict between human good and evil.
Yeah, yawn.
And, you know, we see that they've probed Kirk's mind and Spock's mind and pulled out these characters who are iconic symbols in the races. So, you know, Lincoln is an iconic person in the human race, and Surak is an iconic symbol in the Klingon, Vulcan race, sorry. You know, wouldn't they be able to probe a little bit deeper into Kirk and Spock's minds and look back into time and see the places where good has triumphed over evil.
Yes.
That would negate this whole conflict.
Yeah. Yeah.
It seems like, aliens who are so limitless in their power would be able to clearly see in the past of not only the human, but the Vulcan races, that good has triumphed over evil time and time again and been satisfied.
Right.
That they didn't need to stage this spectacle.
Mm-hmm.
But interestingly enough, I love this Colonel Green character.
Yeah, he's very cool.
Yeah, this is a character that was created in the Star Trek universe between the time that viewers were originally watching this episode in 69 and the 300 years later barrier that was created by this episode. So this is a guy that came to fame or infamy during the time when that viewers would be unaware of. So this is a created character in the human race that people are expected to believe in 1969 was an evil entry into the human pantheon.
Yeah, but I also like the what feels like a very modern sort of portrayal, where we get the explanation that, just because history remembers me as this atrocious monster, doesn't mean that that's all that I am.
Right, yeah, because, Kirk makes a statement to Colonel Green that you're different than history paints you. And of course, in a very brief moment, Green tries to convince Kirk that, history is mistaken before violence erupts. But very interesting that Kirk knows who Colonel Green is, even though the viewers don't. Mm-hmm. And the viewers know who Abraham Lincoln is. So they gave this episode in 1969, gave viewers a reference point into history to Abraham Lincoln and that man that they understood, but also threw in a bunch of references that were artificial.
Right.
And we're supposed to understand that Lincoln is good, so therefore Surak, who is on the side of Kirk and Spock, is also good, and these other characters that they've introduced are supposed to be accepted as evil.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So this is another one of those instances where it seems that Spock's advantages, and of course by osmosis, Surak's advantages, are completely overlooked.
Mm-hmm.
You would think that Kirk would think immediately that, listen, what we need to do is take each of these four villain characters and somehow get them close enough to Spock for a nerve pinch to be executed, and we win.
Yeah.
All it takes is Spock to reach out his hand, grab a shoulder, and knock one of them out in sequence, and this whole episode is over.
Yeah.
But Spock does not nerve pinch a single person in this episode.
Yeah. And I was laughing there at the sort of little rabbit punch that Kirk does, and it almost seemed like a sucker punch.
Mm. Oh, that's a great point. I love the fact that Kirk tries to punch the rock monster. What would have happened if that punch knocked the rock monster out?
Yeah, right.
The communicators still don't work.
It just seems like such a weird move for Kirk.
Yeah, but I admire him for throwing a punch at the rock monster. He didn't attempt that on the Horta.
Good point.
So something in his mind told him that it might work. It might have a chance for success.
And now they've been put back in contact with the Enterprise, really as a means to keep them in line.
Right, and of course to introduce the 4-hour ticking time bomb,
yeah.
Which we're going to hear about. But, this is one of those moments where I'm kind of transported out of the episode, and I started to think about, These are creatures made of rock who we know are able to manifest humanoid creatures who are undetectable to McCoy's scans, but somehow magically they're able to cause havoc to the Enterprise, which is in orbit.
Yeah.
Are we supposed to understand that these creatures have some sort of magical mental powers at this point?
Yeah. It's really, this is a, it's one of the frustrating aspects of this story. And it really boils down to when we were talking earlier about plot conveniences. And it almost makes you thankful is the word maybe that we didn't get a fourth season.
Well, I guess I don't know if I would buy into that, but you know, yeah, this is one of the episodes that makes you scratch your head, whether or not where the fourth season would have gone had they gotten one.
Well, you know, the budgets would have been cut again.
Of course, of course.
And stories would have suffered too, because you know, you wouldn't have had anybody really, you know, standing guard, if you will.
Yeah, everybody would have checked out.
Yeah, yeah. So, well, I mean, you know, it is, you know, I mean, we've got 79 great episodes.
Sure. Well, you know, Craig, this is another one of those ask the listener moments, and I would love to hear some perspective from our regular contributors on this, and this is something that stuck out to me watching this episode this time for our commentary. I kind of watch with a more discerning eye with these episodes when we're going to talk about them. And knowing that the premise of this episode is the rock monsters want to understand the difference between good and evil, is the outcome of a physical conflict between good and evil really indicative of which side is better or worse?
Yeah, but at the same time, are you getting a true indication of good and evil when you're only pulling it from the memories or the collected knowledge of two quote unquote good dudes?
Exactly. No, that's a wonderful point. And you know, if you look at the four humans or the humanoids on the evil side versus the four humanoids on the quote unquote good side, you have a couple of people on the good side who are known negotiators. They're talkers. They're good leaders from a verbal and charisma perspective, who use their mental abilities to negotiate for peace. But on the bad side, you've got several creatures who have fought physically for their dominance, and one who has tortured on a scientific level. So it seems like apples and oranges comparison to me. Who would come out on top? I mean, you know, physically, sure, the bad guys may win, but that doesn't necessarily mean good is quote unquote weaker, you know, from a perspective of one versus the other. So I don't know what outcome the rock creatures are looking for in the, how could it possibly be definitive? Yeah. To their own satisfaction. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Seems a little bit strange. And so,
yeah, I mean, at that point, why not just run a simulation in a computer?
Right, really, exactly. You would think, you know, they would be able to talk through it, right? They would be able to talk through it. So, listeners, and this is another thing that I noticed while watching this episode, and this is an on-screen thing that you can look at. I noticed that Sulak's ears are not as detailed as Spock's ears. It looks almost like Sulak's ears were kind of backup ears, that they kind of kept it in a box somewhere.
That wouldn't surprise me.
So look at you're seeing Spock's ears right now, and you're seeing the detail. It looks that they're realistic, but next time you look at Sulak's ears, it looks like they were kind of half done. You know, especially the bottom portions don't seem like they have the same cuts and lines as the ears that Spock has. So, you know, pay attention to that if you're watching along with us, and I'd love to hear your perspective on that, you know, as we watch through this. And, you know, I not to take anything away from Sulak, I don't want to diminish his presence in this episode, but, you know, obviously maybe Nimoy's ears or his backup ears may not have fit the actor who played Zurak. But it kind of took me a little bit out as I watched. Here, by the way, is another scene where the remastered episode doesn't seem to have a lot of impact. You see a lot of noise in the Blu-ray prints. Mm. And now we're back to a better cut. But there was a brief moment where Zurak was walking towards the camera where we don't see the remastered effect. And I'm wondering what the deal was with that.
Yeah.
You know, I guess there were scenes where they couldn't restore it.
Yeah, maybe the film element was in a certain condition or mm-hmm. they had to use a backup print for certain sections. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a shame because what we're seeing now, you know, is Zurak talking to the evil squad. It looks wonderful.
Oh yeah, it's really the colors are popping. This is almost like reference quality for how good this series can look.
Oh, for sure. And you know people who are watching along with us while we're doing our commentary, pay attention to the Kalis character. You know, future references to Kalis in other series portray him as the Klingon that we know post original series. So the elevated cranium and the augmented skull piece with the extra work. This Kalis looks like Klingons we've seen in the original series proper, and his skin is dark like some of the more notable Klingons. So it's interesting that, you know, post this episode, you know, into other series, I mean, Kalis himself has been referenced in Next Generation and DS9. So interesting to see that he's been modified, mm-hmm. you know, from this original incarnation of Kalis.
Right.
Into the legend that he's become. So I guess we're supposed to understand that he also underwent the augmentation that the other Klingons underwent that we learned about in Enterprise.
Yeah.
So pay a little special attention. So, by the way, this is the number three question that I want to ask the listeners of our show and you, Craig. So knowing that Kalis is the father of the modern Klingon Empire that we know, why would Kalis, the greatest warrior in the Klingon Empire, allow a human, Colonel Green, to call the shots?
Yeah.
In this scenario.
Oh, totally. That is, it almost seems completely a complete betrayal of Klingon character.
Sure. You would think that if you were a fan of Star Trek in general and you'd watched the original the Next Generation and Enterprise and other series, that you would think that a Klingon would take charge of this scenario.
That's an excellent point.
And because he's physically superior to the human Colonel Green. I mean, he could exert himself physically on Colonel Green and put himself in charge. Why would Colonel Green be in charge in this scenario? But then again, if you were just starting out from the beginning and watching just the original series, that may be something that wouldn't occur to you. So very cool. Very cool, different ways to look at these things. And we're seeing that Zurak has attempted to negotiate with the evil faction here and has been captured. And we're meant to believe that Zurak is calling out to Spock for help. This is a very key scene in this episode, I think, because, you know, Spock is looking at this logically.
Yeah.
And he's going to say that a Vulcan wouldn't cry out.
Yeah.
In this type of scenario. But Kirk can't seem to control himself.
Yeah.
In this scenario. And he's blatantly throwing Spock's input aside.
Yeah.
Here. We would expect after all of these scenarios that Kirk has been through with Spock that he would trust Spock's judgment.
Yeah.
But Kirk is willing to charge in. You know, four against one odds to save this potentially, false Zurak.
Yeah.
From being, abused by the evil squad. So, I find it a little bit disconcerting that Spock, I mean, that Kirk, that would throw away Spock's input in this scenario.
Yeah.
I don't know. How do you feel about it?
No, I agree. I mean, you know, to discount, you know, Spock's input there is a huge mistake.
Absolutely. Well, you know, I'm glad that you said that, because it kind of segues into, I want to bring this back up again, is that we're seeing Kirk, Spock, and Abraham Lincoln coming to grips with a strategy.
Yeah.
On a way to combat the situation. And wouldn't you think that Kirk would say, hey, listen, Abraham Lincoln, we should be trying to figure out a way to get each and every enemy within Spock's arm's reach in order to execute nerve pinches and knock every single one of them out, and we could save Surak.
Yeah.
You know, and we've seen Spock do some incredible things. Yeah. We've seen him mentally control people through rock walls.
Yeah. So actually, I want to point out here.
Sure.
There is nothing good in war except its ending. And another excellent section in Mark Cushman's book on this episode is he points out the amount of times that quote is attributed to Abraham Lincoln in real life.
Oh.
When it was a line that was written for the show that Lincoln never actually said.
Wow.
But there have been several instances, and Mark points them out in the book, and even speeches that politicians have given that use that as a quote that's attributed to Abraham Lincoln. So, pretty funny, considering that you see that meme, you know, where they put silly quotes next to Lincoln's name, that could be one of them.
Incredible. I think that is another selling point for Mark's books. You know, I don't want to keep harping on the fact that these really books are amazing, but
yeah.
You know, this is the kind of information that you would glean from reading these books and owning these books. So,
yeah, I mean, if you're at all, I mean, if the fact that you're sitting here listening to me and Jeff talk about these episodes indicates that you hold a certain kind of passion for Star Trek.
Really?
So, yeah, definitely. If you haven't, it would be a really great experience to go get those books and dive into them after you've gone through the series with us, because it'll be another way to explore the series from a different perspective and Mark's incredibly well-researched perspective.
Oh, I can't possibly think of a reason to disagree with you, having read these books up to this point, and you know. You know, you may consider yourself very fortunate that, you know, you're at this point in the third series, the season, that you haven't read these books, because this gives you a whole nother way to look at the original series. If you were to pick up the three seasons worth of books that he has out right now and read them, it would give you so much more insight into these episodes.
Yeah. And not to make this an extended commercial for the books, because they definitely don't need
no.
An extended commercial. I mean, they speak for themselves. But the other great thing about it is it's broken down episode by episode, but there are chapters that fill in gaps, but you can really sit down and read it from beginning to end like a story.
Right. Exactly. And that's kind of how I did it. You know, I've seen these all three seasons many times, and sitting down to read the books, just I kind of went through, and it made me really appreciate the work that went into creating these episodes. No matter how bad I thought the episodes themselves were, it gave me a different perspective on them.
Oh yeah, totally. Totally. Mm-hmm. It definitely gives you an appreciation, at least, for the where people approach things from. And there are some very, very candid words from Fred Freiberger.
Oh yeah. You know what? That's one thing that came out of the talks that we had with Mark that really stood out to me, is the fact that Fred Freiberger is constantly scapegoated for the quote unquote badness of the third season. And it wasn't necessarily his fault.
Yeah.
And he was vilified for it. And, you know, he worked very, very hard on this entire season. It was kind of dumped in his lap.
Yeah.
And, you know, we can look at these episodes now, you know, almost 50 years into the future, and question them and nitpick them. But at the time, you know, Fred Freiberger was trying to live up to an assignment.
Yeah.
That he'd been given, you know, by the studio. And, you know, he was living up to a commitment. And, you know, when you look at these episodes from a 30,000 foot view, you know, you may think they're hokey or corny, but they're really not all that bad. You know, and I want to say that Fred Freiberger did the best that he could. And I think that Mark Cushman's books really serve to illustrate that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and you can say that there's a difference for me, at least, from being bad. Let me amend that. I'd rather have something be bad than boring.
Right.
And a lot of these worst episodes of Star Trek from season 3 that people like to throw around, they're not boring episodes.
No, not at all. And
you have season 1 and 2 episodes that are straight up boring.
You know, I will put myself out there and say that in the past, in conversations, I have volunteered The Savage Curtain as one of my quote-unquote worst episodes of the entire series. But, you know, having said that, you know, I have to look at this episode and understand the circumstances under which it was made and realize that, you know, it treats certain characters very well. It gives Spock a more prominent role than he had in the third series, in the third season. It gives McCoy more input than he had in the third season. And it portrays Kirk rather well against other episodes we've seen in the third season. So,
yep.
You know, whether or not I consider this a quote-unquote good episode or not, that doesn't necessarily have any bearing on where it fits in the ranking of the episodes of all three seasons.
Yes.
You know, here's a prime example of you know, I will tell you right now that I don't think this episode, in my perspective, is a great episode from a story perspective or an execution perspective, but there are some really great moments in this episode that I think really stand out. And one of those things is that, you know, during this entire series up to this point, we've debated, you know, Kirk's decision to get involved in the affairs of various societies and planets that they've encountered. And we've debated the Prime Directive,
yeah,
and Kirk's violation thereof for his own designs or for what he thinks is best for the planet. But I think this episode, in his Kirk's discussion with the rock monster at the end of the episode, actually really serves to drive home a very interesting way of thinking about the Prime Directive and Kirk and Starfleet's motives. So Kirk is arguing at the end with the rock monster as to what gives them the right to take people and put them in these scenarios and force them to fight to their own ends to study them, right? Mm-hmm. And the rock monster's response is, it's the same right that brought you here, the need to know new things.
Yeah.
So can Kirk put himself above an alien race whose motives are essentially the same, mm-hmm, right? So, you know, well, yeah, I've talked beyond the end of the episode here.
Yeah, you got a little extra content this week, folks. We've gone past the running time, so we are now out of the episode proper. But Jeff, I think that was a really interesting point there, and I think there could probably be an episode devoted just to that discussion.
No doubt.
But we do have to finish or put this episode to bed and come up with our essential or non-essential voting. And I don't think it would come as a shock for me to go on record and say that I feel that this is non-essential, even with the reveal of the first logical vote.
Interesting. So I before I cast my vote, I want to make a couple final points about this episode, very short. That this is in the original series, granted we only have 3 episodes left, but this is the final appearance of a Klingon and a full-blooded Vulcan in the original series. So we will no longer see a Klingon or a non-half-human Vulcan as it were, in the rest of the original series. So interesting note there. And this is also the final episode to feature the full original series cast. The final three episodes will not feature the full seven characters of the original series. So,
That's a really nice trivia fact there.
Kind of a sad note. But I am going to go essential on this episode. Oh. And the reasoning for that is we are introduced to two mythological figures that will be constants throughout other Trek series. So Kalis, the father of the Klingon Empire, and Surak, the father of the Vulcan way of thinking, will be mentioned and brought up through various other Trek series. So the Next Generation and DS9 in particular, we will hear of these other characters and see them portrayed through flashbacks and other things. In our season 3 wrap-up, we'll have our resident DS9 expert Chris Ritzer weigh in on Kalis and his other contributions to other series. But I believe that in a universe-expanding way, as rough as this episode is to watch, though, the introductions of those characters who recur in subsequent series are important enough that it would be essential for watchers of Star Trek to see their introductions to the Star Trek universe in this series.
That's a good point.
All right. So that brings us to the end of another episode of the Tricorder Transmissions. Thanks, as always, to all of you listeners for joining us in this episode. And hopefully you will weigh in on Facebook at the Tricorder Transmissions or Twitter feed at TTT_pod. Please weigh in with your opinions on several of the questions that were levied during this commentary. And we will see you again next week on the Tricorder Transmissions. And we're getting closer to the end. Three more episodes until the end of the series, so we hope that we'll hear a little bit more.
We very strongly suspected we were going to be canceled almost immediately after we started the third season. There was a feeling throughout the entire organization that we were just playing out the string, that we were lame ducks, and that when the year was over, that would be it. And some of the episodes actually reflected that. I think there was a significant drop-off in quality of the shows as we progressed deeper into the third season. But we didn't learn that we were being canceled until Gene Roddenberry called us. We stopped shooting sometime in February or March, and or perhaps even April, and it was about 2 months later that Gene called us and said that we had been canceled. And that it was so interesting because he said, hope we can work together again sometime. Now, that was probably the most prophetic comment anybody could have made. And yet it was made, almost idly, in a kind of a flip way. Certainly, he didn't believe that we were coming back, nor did anybody else.
I don't agree with you, Mr. Spock.
Involved with Star Trek.
This is not the first time we've run into historical and mythical figures traveling without a passport in deep space. Remember the Earps and the Clantons in Spectre of the Gun, or the god Apollo in Who Mourns for Adonis? How about the incarnation of Jack the Ripper in Wolf in the Fold? But honest Abe Lincoln? Well, there's a reason for everything, as we'll soon find out. Stay with us.
Star Trek was at its worst undoubtedly those years before we made the first movie. Because there were so many incarnations that it was going through. First it was to be a television show, and then it was to be a movie of the week, and then it was to be a movie, and then it was to be a television show again. So it was the studio's indecision about which way to go with it and how to handle it. And then when Gene had written one, and the studio person who was the head of the studio at the time had said no, it wasn't going going to happen. And at a meeting in New York, the owner of Paramount had said, well, didn't we have a, don't we have something after Star Wars came out? Don't we have something like that? And they said, yeah, it's called Star Trek. He said, well, let's drag it back out again. And those are times that are down. But Gene, you know, he didn't let those things bother him. Again, he was a very, very incredible optimist. And he wanted to keep busy. Quote him, the emotional and physical cost is quite high. It is the artist's calculated risk, like the candle that will burn for just so long. You can force it to burn brighter, but it will also burn faster. You pay for it. Still, I'd rather do that than flicker dimly in a corner.
Gene Roddenberry, Star Trek's creator and co-writer of this episode, was a sickly kid who read a lot and dreamed of being a writer. He became an Army pilot in World War II, and he later flew for commercial airlines. Acting on his dreams, he moved to Los Angeles, where he became a police officer. And dressed in a uniform one day, he frightened a famous Hollywood agent into reading one of his scripts and was quickly hired. He wrote for Naked City, Highway Patrol, Dr. Kildare, A Half Gun Will Travel. He then created the series The Lieutenant, where he met Leonard Nimoy and a few others who would later join him on the Star Trek crew. Along the way, he acquired the nickname Great Bird of the Galaxy. We lost him in 1991. Imagine a world that never met Gene Roddenberry, and imagine a world without Star Trek. How fortunate we are that Gene blessed us with his vision.